So did he say to her?
Good evening, and welcome to the October 2018 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. Our first item this morning, or this afternoon, or evening, is the introduction of our two new health commissioners, which we are very pleased to have with us this evening. To my left, we have Elisa Moylan, and to my right, we have Catherine Shipp. And I'm going to take just a couple minutes. Elisa, you want to take a minute or two to just tell us a bit about yourself?
I'll give it to you very briefly. So my name is Elisa Moylan. I've lived in San Luis Obispo for about 32 years. I've been a nurse in the community. I've been a nurse for 50 years, but in the community since I moved here. I've worked at various hospitals in San Luis Obispo and Arroyo Grande. I am happy to serve on the commission and hope that I can contribute something to the community.
Thank you. Welcome. And to my right, Catherine Shipp. Catherine?
Good evening. I was not prepared. I'm a retired SLO County employee. I worked for the IT department for 13 years. And I'm a mother and a grandmother. And living the SLO life. I love it here. And I'm looking forward to this new adventure.
Thank you as well. And again, welcome to both of you. We are happy to have you with us. Moving on, we need to approve the minutes from our last meeting, which was September 10th. We've all been provided copies of the minutes. Are there any comments, additions, corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, we'll ask Jean to make arrangements to have them published on the website, as they always are. At this time of the agenda, we will offer the floor to anyone that would like to make public comments. Persons desiring to speak on issues other than things that are on our scheduled agenda this evening but are within the scope of interest of the Health Commission, if you please come forward to the microphone, give us your name.
And I'm... Can you hear me now? Perfect. Hi, my name is Nick, and I'm with Prevention and Outreach for Behavioral Health Services. And I'm here to talk about the drug take-back event that we have going on at the end of the month on October 27th on a Saturday. And basically, it's an opportunity for anyone in the community to come and safely dispose of any prescription medications they may have in their households. So one of the reasons this is a big issue that we want to highlight is because in the last year we had approximately 21 reported deaths occur from overdose of opioids. And then there were also about 49, I believe, emergency department visits that occurred as a result of an opioid overdose. And then just in total, there were almost 200,000 prescriptions written in SLO County itself. According to data on CURES, and that equates to if you took all the residents in SLO County, for every two residents, that's a little more than one prescription. So we really want to be able to do our part to make sure that people that have these prescriptions are able to dispose of them properly to limit the amount of overdoses we have going on in the community. Also at the event, we will have free flu shots. So we have three locations, one at Twin Cities Hospital, one at South County Safe in Arroyo Grande, and another at Sierra Vista Hospital. And then also, we don't take sharps to dispose of for the event, but we will be having containers for people that want to dispose of sharps, just because we want to provide access for everybody to be able to dispose of items they want. And then for anybody that's unable to attend the event on the 27th, just some information on other ways they can dispose of their medications. If you go to most pharmacies in SLO County, there's these prescription medication bags that you can pick up. They come with pre-postage, so you just take your medications, put it in the bag, and send it. Or a lot of pharmacies have bins where you can dispose of medications too. And then I have some flyers, too, that I can leave here if anybody's interested. We have both English and Spanish versions.
Yeah. If you'll leave the flyers with Jean, I'm sure we would all like to have some.
Perfect. That's all.
So thank you. Commissioner Campbell, did you have a question? Yeah.
Always.
That's right.
You said, did I hear right that last year there were 200,000 opioid prescriptions written in the county?
Yeah, that came off the website for Cures.
Opioids?
Yeah.
Not all controlled substances.
It might have been, I don't remember for a certain right now if it was opioids specifically or just all prescription medications.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to remind us about that, Nick. So we have two presenters this evening. Our first presenter is not known to any of us, I'm sure. Joel Derringer from Derringer and Associates, and he's going to talk to us about the Behavioral Health Integration Project. And then he will be followed by Jill Bolster-White, who is with Transitions Mental Health Association. Do you guys want a team tag, or do you want... Would you like to do questions after Joel, or I'll leave it up to you?
I'm going to let Joel handle be here, but okay. If there's any question that I can answer.
Yeah, it was sort of funny because I didn't know Jill was on the agenda until we actually put this on the agenda. Anyway, you ready? Anyway, good evening, commissioners. I guess it's been a little while because I actually see new members on the commission besides my old friend.
That's
Lisa.
A good thing, right, Joel?
That's a good thing. I guess... And no one asked for an Affordable Care Act update this year. But it's still here, and I think open enrollment opened and covered California. But what I'm here this evening to talk about is sort of the ending of our Behavioral Health Integration Project, which was a 3.5-year project funded by the Blue Shield of California Foundation. The goal of the project was actually to encourage system-level integration in behavioral health and primary health care. So while we also talk about it at the clinical level, we are trying to get a lot of the agencies together and on a system level provide for integration. We were partially successful. We certainly started a conversation about it. The lead agency on it was Transitions Mental Health Association, so I want to thank Jill and her staff helping move this along. County Public Health was in attendance at every meeting. Behavioral Health, we had Cal Poly, Community Health Centers, SenCal, Dignity, Tenet, and added the Promotores Collaborative actually in the latter 2 years. So we had a series of meetings over about 3.5 years. And what I'm going to do this evening is just give you some of the highlights. One of the big things we did was actually collect some data more on behavioral health and behavioral health integration, because that's actually a little bit harder to get metrics on. So one of the big things in the last several years since 2004 when we started was a huge expansion in benefits coverage, insurance coverage for mental health and behavioral health. A large part of that was the Medi-Cal expansion, which added, we're up to about 55,000 people in the county on Medi-Cal at this point. And at the same time, Medi-Cal and other insurance also had to add behavioral health services, mental health services that previously were not part of the packages. The other big expansion within county behavioral health, which includes drug and alcohol and mental health services, was the Drug Medi-Cal Organized Delivery System, which you may have heard about from Star Graber, which was part of a longer-term Medicaid waiver, and it completely refashioned Drug Medi-Cal. Drug Medi-Cal not being the pharmaceutical side, but helping with substance use disorders. So it's a big change in the county. So one of the things we looked at is what's the demand for mental health services in the county or behavioral health. So these are some rough estimates based on actually statewide and national data. So adults with serious mental illness, it's about 10 to 12,000 residents in the county. Adults with mild to moderate mental health issues is somewhere around 43,000. And I have to tell you, depending upon the data source, the numbers vary quite a bit. And children with mental health issues, and this is not divided, or it's both combining severe and mild and moderate, is anywhere from 12 to 21,000. So there's quite a bit of demand. One thing we can say is having tracked the supply of services and the use of services is actually there's been very large increases in the delivery of services and in the number of people using them, particularly on the outpatient side. If you look at inpatient psychiatric, we're still with the one facility. So we're about 12% of the estimated demand is being met for inpatient mental health services. You know, the county approved in the planning process a facility in Templeton, and that's on track for the next 3 years. I mean, I talked to the developers not that long ago, and it's still, I don't know that they've even selected an operator, yet alone started construction. So it's still several years off. So in terms of provider staffing, how much staffing? It's actually looking pretty good. So the top, the orange bar, SenCal, which, you know, is our Medi-Cal agency, added providers went up 124% from when they first started to needing to provide mental health services for mild to moderate population. They had 62 on their list in 2015, and it's way up to 139. These are all administered through the Holman Group, which is the mental health subcontractor for SenCal. CHC, Community Health Centers, just going down to the blue, it actually has fluctuated quite a bit on the number of behavioral health providers. At least at the time that I had the data for the report, it was up 12%. They had just added quite a few providers. I don't know what the most recent is. The county drug and alcohol was up 36%. And I'm looking at that. Oh, actually, it's county mental health is up 12%. Somehow the blues are combining. I don't know if they are on yours. But in any case, services are up. So we can see the only place where there was a slight drop in the number of providers was actually at Cal Poly. So that's how what the supply is for services. In terms of how we're meeting demand, so SenCal services, these are the ones from mild to moderate. It was a new benefit in 2014. It's been up 132% since 2014. We're also, on the other hand, it's reaching about a third of those who we would expect to need or to utilize those services based on the earlier data that I showed you on expected demand. So we're reaching 20% in 2014. We're now reaching over 30%. So there's a big increase, but there's also a large way to go. County Behavioral Health, with its increased staffing, was able to see 38% more people with serious mental illness between 2014 and 2017. And they're actually reaching a higher percent of the estimated population than the statewide data would suggest. So they're actually doing a pretty good job in reaching them. This says, in terms of just sheer quantity, we don't have data on the intensity of services, exactly how many services each one is getting. But in terms of clients actually seen in county mental health, it's reaching pretty much the estimated demand. At the same time, there are gaps in populations. Spanish-speaking clients are still not being reached in any way in terms of what the expected demand would be. Some of that has to do with Spanish-speaking providers, and a lot of it has to do with probably a lot of cultural stigma and lack of outreach in terms of accessing services. Emergency departments, you know, it's interesting. I was trying to, so yours hearing the hospitals are totally inundated with mental health cases. So some of them have, so I looked at emergency department, what they call mental disorder discharges, and there's a big caveat in that that I'll get to. And it did increase at all but one of the hospitals. The big caveat is the way they're coded, and these are primary discharge diagnoses. And if you talk to ER docs, I'll say, well, they came in, you know, with a head injury that may have been from a fall from a substance use disorder, but they get discharged with a head injury, and it may be the third or fourth diagnosis lower down that it's some behavioral health disorder. So, and there's not always consistent reporting among all the providers. So that's the ERs. The mental disorder discharges from the hospitals also were up across all the hospitals, but again, that's also in part a coding issue. So this is just graphically showing. The red line is county mental health is up 38%, and CenCal, you know, more than doubled what the people that they were reaching. So one of the other pieces, besides collecting data, one thing we did was hold a series of focus groups. So while there's good news in the data, both in the our supply to provide services and in the utilization, when you go and actually talk to the clients and the users, we did two sets of focus groups, and one in 2015 and one in 2018. We did both English and Spanish language focus groups. And there really hadn't been a big change in terms of attitude by clients or users of this system over the 3 years. They still felt that there were long waits for to get an appointment. And then when they had an appointment, there was a long wait to actually get to see the provider. There were still gaps in continuity of provider, seeing the same provider, seeing for what the patient felt was a sufficient time. And certainly the thing that came up again is just having people listen to me. Stop looking at the computer and actually look at me and listen. And Jill can talk more about that. So we did some training on empathy, but we didn't, to reach the medical providers, but we didn't actually call it empathy training, because no one would have come, because we're all empathetic. So in terms of integration, there was sort of a split between, yes, I really want my providers to talk to one another so I can get better care as a whole person. On the other hand, I'm really afraid of stigma, that if the orthopedist sees that I have a mental issue, they're going to stigmatize me and treat me differently. So there was sort of a split on that, and often I think they wanted their primary care providers to know more about sort of what medications they were on, but they're also worried about providers just treating them differently if they knew that they had some mental illness issues. Transportation was always an issue. Now, one thing is transportation is now a required benefit under Medi-Cal for all services, not only the CenCal services. I don't know that a lot of people know that, but as of, I guess, earlier this year or maybe late last year, it's been required that CenCal arrange transportation not only for their medical services, but also mental health, behavioral health, and dental issues are a required CenCal benefit. The other thing is people spent a lot of time negotiating the system or navigating the system, negotiating too. Just trying to figure out when appointments were, where things were, who to talk to, how to get services. So they really felt that case or system navigators, sort of case assisters, would be really benefit. And in the Spanish-speaking focus groups, it came up in every time about having not only sufficient Spanish-speaking, but also culturally appropriate providers who they could relate to. So what did we do within the project? One is we increased a lot of, what we tried to do is increase communication among the providers, and I'll talk about what some of this would be. We did a series of trainings on patient navigation. Transitions was able to hold a week-long training with the funding we had from Blue Shield for, I think, probably 25 or 30 patient navigators, mm-hmm. Several of whom went on to get fully certified. As I said earlier, we sponsored trainings for providers on empathy and patient communication. We brought in a really excellent outside consultant to do those trainings and offered continuing ed credits. And we even got a few docs at them. And we actually got some good feedback from several of them. They were really integrating it into their practices. The other thing that happened, which was somewhat, and this is the informal thing of what you can never predict in these grants, was there were two major grants that various entities in the county applied for and were granted by SAMHSA, which is the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. One was for county behavioral health patients, the seriously mentally ill, to receive health services within the county mental health department. You know, usually we talk about integration of that we need therapists at the primary care clinic. This was actually bringing in clinical care and wellness services into county behavioral health. It's had its struggles, but still moving along. I don't know that, you know, I've been to several conferences on it, and no one has succeeded in the first year. Some have shown some improvement in over 4 years, so we're still in the game. The other thing is the Community Action Partnership applied for a SAMHSA grant to create this integrated hub, and these actually all involve transitions. There's sort of three or four aids, you know, it's county transitions, community health centers, are probably sort of the triad of, and SenCal to some extent, are the triad in these. So the Slow Hub grant is actually through the Community Action Partnership along with transitions and the county.
Right? Yeah.
Maybe
right.
Jill has that on one of her slides.
Well, you know what? I can just mention while we're on this slide. So as Joel said, the Slow Hip Project is trying to take the next step of integrating with community health centers and behavioral health, trying to get that integration of physical health and behavioral health to take place up at the campus, the behavioral health campus. And I think the other thing I just wanted to mention about the empathy trainings was it was so, I think, really fascinating for those of us who were able to attend the training to see that actually feeling empathy in a visit with a doctor, starting from when you walk in the door, actually affects your physical health and your mental health outcomes. So it shouldn't be surprising for those of us who worked in mental health, but that was really interesting that there's a lot of data that shows if you're sort of approached with the closed window by the receptionist, which most of us are, and you just that sort of continues through your whole visit, you're not going to share any mental or emotional distress you have. You're probably not going to get nearly as good a care, and you're not going to be as open. And that actually translates into worse physical health outcomes. So again, it seems logical, but it was really fascinating to have this training and have seen all this research that went into that. And so now it's a required training for all the staff at Transitions Mental Health Association because it was so remarkable from receptionists all the way through to see how much of an impact that had. And the other thing I'd mention is the navigation training was all people who have a lived experience with mental illness. So we took a lot of our peer folks within programs and did navigation training because who better to talk about navigating our very complicated systems than people who've had to do it themselves and come on the other side. So thanks for letting me in. Tying into
that was a lot of client empowerment or patient and people with lived experience. And Transitions has had their PAT team, which is the
Peer Advocacy Advisory Team.
Right. There's another two counties I work with PAT teams that have different acronyms, and I can never remember which they are. But one thing we did, so on our second set of focus groups and surveys, is we actually had the PAT team members go through trainings and conduct the focus groups. So they were, in a way, peer-to-peer focus groups. So that was really empowering for them. One other thing that came out of it, this is the For those of you who are in the social service system here, the 815 form, which used to be called the DSS 815 form, it's a multi-agency release form. It had been used within the community, more in the social services sectors, for many years, and it's a legacy form. But it wasn't HIPAA compliant, and it wasn't compliant with the substance use disorder regs, 42 CFR Part 2. So what it really took was sort of introducing the county health agency privacy officer to the Department of Social Services person and saying, you know, we can make this work. So, you know, it was a lot of county health agency was Ken Tassif, who's unfortunately now moved to Sonoma, I think, who really put it together and created this compliant form. It's available on the web as a fillable PDF. And we also got it signed off by legal counsel from Tenet, from Dignity, from the county. So we really got everyone to say, okay, this is a great release form to at least start the conversation. We're never going to have one application form. You know, I think public health has its other 12 forms, but at least it allows people to, you know, providers to talk to one another. It's gone through additional changes because Part 2 changed earlier in the year, or maybe late last year, which made it even more complicated. But I think we're up with a fully compliant form at this point. So what's left to do? One is the actual integration of the services and the systems. We certainly have made starts. We've learned where some of the bottlenecks are. We've had a community consensus. Well, what the work yet to do is actually to have community consensus on behavioral health services and resources. You know, it was a tough year within the county system, more related to the jail and issues there. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of focus on sort of incarcerated populations and what to do on the criminal justice side. We haven't had a much bigger discussion about how do we actually stop all these people from being in the criminal justice system? How do we get a little higher up and upstream to really prevent it? And there are things that are happening, but there's still a lot to be done on sort of pre-criminal justice interventions. The data that we were able to collect, you know, you would think it would be relatively simple to ask someone how many behavioral health clients did you see and what were their ages. It's not. I mean, there were well-meaning people in each agency who would have then asked their data people for it, and 3 months later, maybe we would get something. And, oh, you wanted it for our county? Yes, please. Thank you. And then there's still all the funding silos. So, you know, we've never talked about integrating, or we've gone beyond talking about integrating funding to try and braiding funding, because we really don't have control over a lot of the state and federal funding and how it comes down in different silos. But we, on a local level, I think have learned on how to braid it, a lot of it together. And, you know, one of the real advantages to having had our BHIP meetings monthly or every other month was just a lot of crosstalk. There was a lot of opportunity for people to ask. We'd also done a sort of qualitative evaluation internal of the BHIP process, and I think that was one of the big assets in it, is that people said, well, we got to learn about other agencies and what they could do and couldn't do and what they wanted to do and why, even if they wanted to do something, they couldn't do something. So it really helped in understanding other agencies. So I think that's it. And I don't know if you have questions, if you want to wait for Jill to go.
It's up to you.
Do we have questions for Joel? Let's take a couple if we have any. Susan, you look like you have a question.
What a surprise.
What a surprise, Joel. Okay. One of the first questions I had down here was when I noticed that drop in Cal Poly providing services, yet their numbers of students are increasing. Are our county services and I know the hospital ERs are, absorbing these Cal Poly students? And, you know, you said they were there for the discussion. What are they doing?
So the drop was actually in number of providers. They're actually up 16% on the number of clients that they're seeing.
Right.
And when there was a drop in providers, it was probably one, but they are actually seeing more. I don't have, or maybe...
Actually, Joel, I might be able to help with that. Okay. I just met, there's a new director of health and wellness services over at Cal Poly. She just moved here from Berkeley. She was working in the health and wellness department at Berkeley, at Cal Berkeley. So they have hired a psychiatrist. They have a very robust team of mental health folks over at their health and wellness center. And she actually came from a model of integrated behavioral health and primary care. So she talked about how that was the model they had at Berkeley. She was really excited about the fact that that was something she wanted to do here. And so actually, I think we're having lunch with a bunch of the folks who were part of the BHIP grant to introduce her to the community, since she's new to the community. So I'm feeling very hopeful and excited about Cal Poly.
That's great. Good.
Thank you.
On the hospital mental health discharges, were the, like, the opioid overdoses wrapped into the mental health discharge?
So these were mental disorders, is the term that they use, psychoses and neuroses. So no, it did not include substance use disorders.
Okay, so are we keeping, are they keeping track at all of?
Well, I think certainly the Opioid Safety Coalition is on top of it. I mean, you heard in public comment, you know, that they're really tracking it, and is the Opioid Safety Coalition website? I mean,
I can jump in on that one. There's five action teams of the Opioid Coalition, and one of them is called the Data Action Team, and the public health epidemiologist is deep in, up to our elbows in data on hospital admissions and ER discharges for opioid-related conditions. Again, same problem, though, if it's not listed at the top. It's a lot more work to actually dig down, which she is doing to try to get secondary, tertiary diagnoses.
Right. And so when you actually talk to the doctors, is they don't want pushbacks from the patients, because they look at the discharge, say, what? You're calling me a drug user? You know, so it's easier to write head trauma on it and not deal with some of the other issues.
Okay. And for now, one last question here. And thank you for sending these ahead of time and having the opportunity to go through them. On the substance use disorders, on the estimated demand, are we breaking down, say, drug and alcohol services, since they're the primary treatment provider in this county for substance use, mandated versus voluntary clients?
And I would what those imagine, percentages are? Well, no, I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask Ann Robin and the behavioral.
Right, and when we're doing these kinds of things, I would really think that we need to look at that so that we know what our estimated demand is in the voluntary population, because that's a really tough one.
Right.
And if they're 80% mandatory, then we're very underserved in the community.
Yeah, the demand data comes from some data the state issued a few years ago to help in sort of forecasting services. I don't know that they broke down anything between voluntary and mandatory.
Okay, well, I think that's kind of a unique situation in this county, because we don't have a lot of private providers, so.
Right.
It's something for us to keep track of. Thanks. Okay.
Any other questions at this time? Gina?
Hi, good evening. I think your light's off now. Yeah. There you go.
Okay, I work in primary at CHC. So I would say about 30% of my patients are coming in for mental health help. If this is something mild, then we treat it at the primary. If it's something moderate, then we send to our behavior health.
Right.
But between us, when you talk about behavior health and primary collaborating together, that works well in our clinics, and for me anyway.
Okay.
But we actually share chart notes that includes medication database. But whenever I send patients to county, some of the severe cases, schizophrenia, addictions, along with PTSD, whatnot, that I know our behavioral health would not, you know, see them. Right now, the way it's working is that I just give them county mental health number. And there is no way for us to follow through. And we never get any chart notes back from county mental health. So is there going to be, since we're talking about primary and behavioral health collaborating, how is that going to work from going forward? It would be nice if we can actually send, when I send patients, just like how I refer patients out, right? There is a way, like a contact, like county has a referral intake, and we can actually send the referral to the county, and my chart note, as well as patients, all the medications, all their labs can go directly to the county, just like how I refer my patients to any other specialty, and that's not happening right now. And sometimes when I send the patients to county, you know, let's say a patient was put on lithium, I have no idea knowing the patient's on lithium, and there are times, you know, the lithium level wasn't checked properly with the, because county is also changing, right, because you don't have permanent psychiatrist, right, psychiatric nurse practitioners, or you don't. So I think there is a disconnect between the follow-ups on certain lab orders and whatnot. And thing is, if I don't know, that, then if no one's checking that, I need to check it at my end. So they don't end up in a ER, right?
Right. No, it's a serious issue.
Yeah, and there had been. So I wonder if there is a way that we can connect that communication. Like when I refer, so you have everything that I have about the patient. And then when I also get, just like I get consultation note from other specialty, they request. And if there is nothing, that things are not done, then I know that I need to follow that patient.
So I guess I can say a few things. Mm-hmm. One is Magdalena Serrano, who's your behavioral health director, has been very active in this. And the other thing is she's really been instrumental, I think, in getting the Slow Hip Project moving,
right,
which is actually trying to bring CHC into county behavioral health. And I do know within that project, I don't know what's happened with it, there was funding actually for IT for exactly these issues, to track those patients and be able to go back and forth and share information. At the same time, you know, the county's been trying to get a health information exchange up and running for several years. Every year it's closer. I don't know where it is this month. And part of that was also allowing for county behavioral health to have the confidential part of it, because there's still all the part two issues in the HIE. So that, and I know CHC is also part of that discussion. But, you know, you bring up what are really some very serious issues, especially where you're sharing patients, but you don't know what's going on.
No. And I oftentimes don't know what a patient has even seen, because if there are so severe cases, oftentimes homeless and et cetera, they don't go. And sometimes if they don't have addiction issues, but, you know, mental health, we can actually case manage certain patients. But we have a limited resource on the case management. Mm-hmm. And SenCal have case management and some complicated cases that I could actually have SenCal to case manage.
Right.
But mental health with the county, I don't think that's possible.
Yeah, and mental health, so the county mental health is carved out from SenCal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So as I said, we never, you know, we're making some progress, but certainly you're bringing up some very serious issues that still exist.
I would agree with Penny, that if you refer one of your patients who needs county behavioral health services to that Slow Hip program and connect with Magdalena in your office, and then Donna Hayes is the county contact, that might be an easier conduit. But wouldn't you also use the 815 form and have a release signed by your patient, so when they do open up a case at county mental health, if you have that 815 form that you are asking your patient to share that information, that seems like that would also facilitate that.
But when the patient goes to county, don't they automatically sign that form so information can come to us, just like they do it in any other specialty?
If the patient discloses that they're your patient. But if they don't, then maybe you would want to do it on your end, so you'd have that in hand to get to the county staff to access their information.
Right.
So coming from the, it's an extra step for you.
Yeah, we but see, we don't have a setup for that because we do our...
Right,
yeah,
what you want to do is open the chart and say, oh, here's the report.
Right, the report
and there's no automatic transfer of information.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the one thing I was just going to add is this year, after a few years of effort on Ann Robin's part, is County Health Agency, the Behavioral Health Department, was provided funding from the county to create three new case management positions, one for each outpatient clinic. And they, I'm not sure if they've completed the hiring on that, but I know that there's a lot of hope and expectation that they will be able to serve in the role that you're talking about to create information exchange.
And I think you mentioned that CHC has actually hired behavioral health case managers as well, is my understanding.
We have, no, we don't have actually behavioral health case managers. We do have behavioral health people coordinating it.
Okay.
But they, we really, I mean, they're just busy coordinating our own behavioral health, you know, LCSWs, so our psych people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the case manager at the county will be great, so we know the point contact. Right. Mm-hmm. Jean?
I have a question about medication reconciliation. So I'll talk with patients after discharge, and they'll say, I'm not sure really what I want to take, and they've visited different agencies. Does that form address that issue? And the other question that comes up is, I can only get 9 medications, and how do you prioritize what they get?
The form allows for communication among providers. It doesn't actually provide any information. I mean, the HIE might somewhere down the road. In terms of the 9, that's a Medi-Cal restriction. I'm thinking back 20 years or something.
If you have, you know, some of those psychoactive meds, how do we prioritize them so that they keep that constant state?
Well, and this is why you want to integrate both the psychiatric and the primary care, so at least someone's looking at the whole list.
Is that going to be done? Is that something you're looking at?
You know, I'd say at this point, that's another one of those issues to go on. You know, as I said, sort of the project is, you know, right. Well, it's also ended after 3.5 years. But the same group of people continue to meet under the auspices of the other two SAMHSA grants. So these are also good issues. CAPSLO has taken on organizing those meetings. So these, you know, but pretty much the same people. I know Dr. Borenstein goes and Ed Robin goes, Jill and her team go because they're all part of the grant. So these are things that can be brought up there and worked on.
I'm making notes, Jean.
Set the next agenda.
Okay, so Joel, you'll stay for a few minutes to see if there are other questions.
Great. Thank you very much.
And we'll turn the floor over to Jill before she catches cold because it's freezing in here.
Good luck.
Jill is with Transition Mental Health Association, and we have certainly known her over the years, but... Welcome. We're glad you're here with us this evening.
Thank you for inviting me. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about what we do at Transitions Mental Health Association. In Joel's presentation, our services were included under County Behavioral Health because that County Behavioral Health is a primary funder and partner for Transitions Mental Health Association in most of the projects and programs that we embark on. So here is our mission statement. So we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we are dedicated to eliminating stigma and promoting recovery and wellness for people with mental illness. And those are our 4 primary areas: work, housing, community, and family support. We keep talking about how limiting those 4 pillars are because we do, Joel mentioned, pre-law enforcement engagement. We've been involved quite a bit there. We have done more and more in homeless services where there's an overlap between homelessness and mental illness. So those roughly cover the services that we provide. Our services are countywide here in San Luis Obispo, and we also were approached many years ago by Myrna McMillan, the director of county mental health for Santa Barbara County, about providing services in Santa Maria and Lompoc. There wasn't a community-based organization providing services, and so they asked. She had been the mental health director here in SLO County, and when she moved down to Santa Barbara, she'd asked if we would provide services. So we do work in those two underserved communities. So again, housing, employment, family support and family services, and a whole wide variety of community services. And that includes community education. I think one of the early lessons I had when I was a young executive director a long time ago was just how little people knew about mental illness and how little they understood about treatment, about distinguishing it from developmental disabilities. There were just were so many misconceptions over the years. And of course, we still see stigmatizing behavior. That was a big outcome in our focus groups with mental health clients, as Joel mentioned, and talking to their primary care providers. They were very worried that they wouldn't be believed, that their reporting would be undermined by that information that they had a mental health diagnosis. So this statistic comes from NAMI, that 1 in 4 adults, approximately 61.5 million Americans, experience a mental illness in a given year. And so kind of going through and doing the math with our population here in San Luis Obispo County, that has about 54,000 people experiencing a mental illness. And of that number, 11,000 would be considered to have a severe or persistent mental illness. And that's really the population, as you well know, that the County Behavioral Health Department serves, and primarily the population that transition serves. This gives you a little breakdown of the number of people that we serve. So it breaks our programs down. We have a robust family services department, so we provide one-on-one support resources. We have family support groups countywide. We have a Spanish language family support group in Paso Robles. But most of the folks who are needing our family services are parents who have an adult or a minor child who has a mental illness. But we also have people who have siblings, who have parents, adults who may have a parent who has a mental illness. And we've even supported people who have colleagues and coworkers and roommates who are mentally ill. So that may look like a lot of different things, a one-time phone call from somebody in crisis, or maybe years of ongoing support for those folks. We run a couple of small businesses. We run Growing Grounds Farm and Growing Grounds Downtown, and those are the work programs. We have a wide variety of community programs. I'll talk a little bit more in detail about what those are. And our clinical services are done in partnership with the County Behavioral Health Department, and those are mostly funded by Mental Health Services Act funding. And that funding identified the most, sort of the highest need folks within the mental health system, and really wanted to provide some intensive wraparound services. So making sure there was funding for housing, funding for some clinical and medical services, and so those are called full service partnership programs. We are riddled with acronyms and initials, and so FSP is a term you will hear a lot around our office. Housing is something we've done more and more of. We do a lot in partnership with the Housing Authority, and that's been a great partnership over the years. That the creativity of our local Housing Authority has always benefited our mental health and homeless clients. And then, as I mentioned, we've really expanded homeless services over the years as homelessness has emerged as a greater and greater and more visible issue. Let's see. This is the breakdown of our client ethnicity. So fairly representative of the county, 51% of the people we serve are Caucasian, 34% Latino or Hispanic, and then as you can see, smaller percentages of folks within the African American, Asian, and Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander community. Our client gender is 58% female and 42% male. That's actually shifted over the years. When I started 26 years ago, we actually served about 60% men and 40% women, and so that's shifted. And that actually matches the diagnosis rate. More women tend to be diagnosed with mental health conditions than men. We primarily serve adults. So we work in partnership with Family Care Network that provides quite a few services for children. We do have a residential treatment program for teens, and so that's that little tiny sliver on the pie chart. 6% of the people we serve are that transitional age, youth age, and that's actually a number we're really trying to expand. That's the age of diagnosis for most people, 16 to 25. And the problem is that in that age group, usually people don't want to admit that they're mentally ill, or they look and they start services and look around, and they're often the youngest one in a support group or in a housing setting. And it's really hard in a county of our size to have very specialized services. We do have some support groups for young adults, but I think that could really help decrease the numbers of folks who need intensive crisis services later on if we were able to help people get diagnosed and treated earlier. 71% of our folks are sort of right in the middle age, young adult and middle age zone, and then 23% are older adults. This is just a snapshot of our budget over the last couple of years. So again, I think we've been called upon to do more within the jail setting and to do more with homeless services. So actually, we're contracting with the Department of Social Services for a couple of programs that I'll talk about. And then, how do I describe Bishop Street Studios? So this is the was originally built as an orphanage in 1931 and was on the county campus when the county bought the property. And Lisa probably knows more when that was, because I know you lived in that neighborhood. You still do. Oh, you do. So the county, I think, bought the property in the 60s, and they own that 29 acres that probation department and behavioral health and drug and alcohol and public health use. And this building was used as a juvenile facility by the county until 1974 and then was abandoned. And so we have actually gone through the retrofitting process, and we're going to be converting that. Oh, yeah, there's a picture of how it looked. I know, alarming. And what we're doing now is converting the building and building three new structures for 34 units of supported housing for people who have a mental illness. So we are well on our way. And it's really exciting because this housing, we could probably build 10 projects like this and fill them up very quickly. This is a picture of our youth treatment program. It is designed to be a short-term residential treatment program for children ages 12 to 18. And so it's, again, funded by the Mental Health Department and the state of California. And so it's a 6-bed program that serves boys and girls. And then we have an adult sort of corollary to that. And so this is also an intensive transitional program for people who might have had a stay at the county inpatient unit or been at an out-of-county psychiatric placement. And so this is also funded by county behavioral health. And people can stay in this program up to a year. Both of these treatment programs have 24-hour staff and medication support and therapy included as part of the program. So they're really designed to be transitional stabilization programs. This is a picture of our full-service partnership housing. So it is an apartment complex in Atascadero, and it has a more intensive level of housing support. And that was funded by Mental Health Services Act housing funding. We have a federal government HUD-funded permanent housing for homeless program. And so in that program, again, it's done in partnership with the Housing Authority, and people graduate from that program with a Section 8 voucher. But again, it's really designed to have for people who meet a very strict federal definition of homelessness to get on track and housed. And we've had very good success. 89% of folks still housed after 2 years in the program is a very high success rate, because these are all people who have been homeless for at least one, for 2 years in the last 5 years. So that it tends to be a pretty chronically homeless population. We This is a property that we own, and it's in the downtown Arroyo Grande area. So we have a wellness center is in the older house on the lower left corner, and then we built 5 units of housing. So we really tried to provide housing in all the communities that we serve, because my first job with the agency was actually running the wellness center in Arroyo Grande, and all the people in that drop-in support program were born and raised in Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach, had been there for many, many years. And it really was made clear to me how important it is to be in the community where your family is. And so it's been important as an organization for us not just to center all the services in the city of San Luis Obispo, but to try to really have those services be provided in the communities where people are from. This is a housing project and a wellness center in downtown San Luis Obispo. Again, as you can see, I have an affection for older houses, and so we bought this property and were able to convert the house into a wellness center and then to build 8 studio units of housing for folks. And again, so far, all the housing and treatment I've described is all open and out for people who have an open case with the County Behavioral Health Department. This is our team of community residential providers, and so what this team basically does is provide residential case management. And I think you all know, for people who have the kinds of mental illnesses that we serve, people with schizophrenia, people with schizoaffective disorder, clinical depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and who are disabled by their mental illness, really support and case management is a critical element for them to remain stably housed. And so that's what this team does. So again, they don't live on site, but they do check in and have house meetings. A lot of this housing is congregate, so we might lease a 4-bedroom house and everybody has their own room, and we conduct weekly house meetings, sort of check in with people. We're half landlord and half mental health case manager in this program. The 50 Now program is one we started a couple of years ago. And again, this was in response to the 10-year plan to end homelessness. The Housing Authority basically put forward 50 Section 8 vouchers and basically challenged the Board of Supervisors to sort of provide a program to house 50 homeless folks. So we responded to the request for proposal, partnered with CAPSLO, with the El Camino Homeless Organization, 5 Cities Homeless Coalition, CHC was part of that discussion, and of course HASLO. And the Department of Social Services funded this program. And I, frankly, was very, very nervous because it was our first Housing First model. And I think I've talked about this with Mary Jean. This is a small town, and I see people at the grocery store, and I see people at farmers market, and I just had nightmares about people, you know, living next to one of these housing programs and saying, what have you done? You know, what is this? And so the thing about Housing First, though, is it really works. The philosophy is that you don't say you need to be clean and sober for a month before we'll even talk to you about housing, or that you need to take medications for your mental illness. You really literally take somebody off the street and you put them into housing. And so what we've done is done exactly that. So there are people who have continued to use, and we found that they're pretty motivated to stay in the housing, and their roommates or housemates are very motivated to stay in housing. And so that actually ends up working as sort of a mini community. And we've had amazing success. Almost, well, as you can see on your slide, almost 100% reduction in jail days for the people who we've housed, and a 70% reduction in PUF days, and a little bit over 50% reduction in ER stays. So it's made a gigantic difference for those folks. They were chosen by going through, you might have heard the VI SPDAT survey. Have you heard of that term? Oh, you're so lucky. It's a terrible term. But what it is a vulnerability index, and it basically looks at 8 areas of vulnerability, sort of mental health, substance use, cirrhosis of the liver, HIV. So looks at these really, really high high need outcome areas, and if people score high on this, then they're eligible for this housing. So we actually housed 54 people right off the bat, and within the first year, 6 people died. That's how serious this population was, and it was frankly devastating for the staff. We just weren't used to that level of people passing away. But because of the selection process, because of that vulnerability index, that's the population we were looking at. And so what we tried to just sort of console ourselves was that they died housed. Many of them were in touch with their family for the first time in many years and were at least being treated for whatever kinds of diseases or illnesses. But people had end-stage cancer. They had cirrhosis of the liver. You know, as you can imagine, these are people with, they just had a very, very high morbidity, and that's what brought them into the program. There currently are 54 people housed, and the Board of Supervisors last spring did add 10 more beds, and the Housing Authority gave us 10 more vouchers. So we're really, really excited, and we've really, again, worked hard to spread the housing countywide so we can really try to provide these services where people live. Okay, whoops, put down my clicker. This is our homeless outreach team. This was also funded by the Mental Health Services Act. And the way this team differentiates from 50 Now is they really are looking for people who have a mental illness, and that's what's caused their homelessness, more than likely. So it's sort of the folks who we see on the street who may appear to be mentally ill and who are known by law enforcement, who are known by park rangers. So this team works countywide. We have a nurse. We have a medication specialist. We do work a lot with county drug and alcohol services, but we're really interested in adding a drug and alcohol specialist to this team, and I think that's the next hire we'll do. But they really work intensively. Sometimes it takes over a year to engage with somebody and to really draw them into mental health services because they've either had terrible experiences or part of their mental illness may be paranoia that really causes them to just not want to engage with any institution. And so that's a big part of the job of this team. We have, these are the, I mentioned FSP and AOT, assisted outpatient treatment is actually an effort that the Board of Supervisors directed the Behavioral Health Department to look at, and that is to try to come up with a way to adhere to people's civil rights in refusing mental health treatment, but people who we also know teeter on that edge of grave disability. So you've probably heard the term 5150. That's when someone can be involuntarily hospitalized. But many folks, and homeless folks, as well as people who are mentally ill, really don't represent a severe harm to themselves or others, even though they may be homeless, they haven't eaten, you know, they may be experiencing psychotic symptoms. The assisted outpatient team is designed to see that a person has been jailed, has been engaging with law enforcement, maybe a family member has said, gosh, I really am worried about my, let's say, adult child, and they're making threats, but it just doesn't move into that area of involuntary hospitalization. The way the assisted outpatient team works is they work in the civil court system and utilize a judge and their black robe effect to see if they can induce the person into voluntary mental health services. So it's sort of a complicated thing, trying again to work within appropriate laws, but also to really try to help people who need help and their mental illness is really causing them to stay away. And that's one of the trickiest things, especially, as I mentioned, people who have paranoia as part of their symptoms. It's so hard to get folks to feel like they can trust any treatment whatsoever. And so that can be just very, very difficult. And then the full service partnership team is basically providing very intensive services. So on that team of folks in the picture are therapists, medication specialists, substance use specialists, and a couple of people who've been homeless themselves and who really help navigate the system. We're part of the Behavioral Health Treatment Court, and that is a way that people who have committed crimes can plea to receive mental health treatment rather than jail time, and so that's sort of the consequence if somebody falls out of treatment. And so we have a therapist on that team that works with the probation department and mental health. We have a couple of people who work with the jail and who identify people who either enter the jail with a mental illness or are diagnosed while they're at the jail and help them to have a little bit of a warmer handoff when they're released. So they'll know a little bit more about housing, about other services. We've also been doing some support groups within the jail for men and women who have mental illness, again, just to talk about services out in the community and some of the things that they can expect. Our farm. We have a wholesale nursery here in San Luis Obispo, and some of these pictures are of that program, and that's designed to be a small business that employs people who are mentally ill. And we also have a farm in Santa Maria, and so these are pictures of people planting plants and harvesting berries. But again, the idea is that this is a very therapeutic kind of work environment, and it really is very helpful to get people back on track if they're interested in getting back to work. Well, there's our downtown store. And then we have a supported employment program that places people into community jobs. So this is a woman who's working at Miners, and we work with a lot of different employers around the county to place people in jobs when they're ready to work in the community. And that is partially funded by the Department of Rehabilitation, the State Department of Rehab. I mentioned our family services. This is our team of family advocates. Most of the members of the team are bilingual, and so they're able to provide services in Spanish. They do work with families who have a loved one that's part of the court process, who maybe can go to court and help the family know what the options are and help them navigate that. As I mentioned, we have weekly support groups throughout the county, and this is really important. This service is funded by the county, but any family member who needs the service, it's available to them, and it's completely free. This is a survey that we gave to people who were using our family advocacy services, and mostly what we hear is that people are really thankful that there's a resource, that there's a place they can go to get their questions answered. Most of the family advocates that we hire have a family member who's been through the system, and so they're in a great position to be able to talk about how to navigate it and what to expect, and that can be really helpful. Even talking about giving somebody a list of attorneys for a special needs trust, that comes up sometimes as people are aging. But anyway, just trying to help people find whatever resources they need. And then community, I'll zip through this. These are our wellness center programs. And again, these are all designed for anyone in the community who self-identifies as having a mental illness. Most of the staff have lived experience with mental illness. We have a program in Arroyo Grande, and you see the house in San Luis Obispo. We have a wellness center in Atascadero, and we are sharing office space with RISE up in Paso Robles to provide some support groups and wellness center activities up there. So sometimes they may talk about managing the symptoms and side effects of medication. Sometimes it'll be just practicing going to the market. Most of the people we work with are very poor. They're on Social Security disability, so they have about $920 a month in income. So eating well on a budget is really important. And so just a whole wide variety of things, but also just acts as a support group. And then this is a list of some of the other teams we have working in clinics. Joel mentioned the Slow Health Integration Project, so that's working with community health centers and San Luis Obispo County's behavioral health. We got a grant for a high school education program, and we've been working countywide to educate students in high schools and middle schools. I have a son at San Luis Obispo High School, and so I know. If you can believe it. I know it's hard to believe I'm that old, but I am. And then my daughter is at the middle school, and she came home and said, "Mom, somebody from your work came to my school today." I know, so funny. And so it's been great, though. They're learning about mental health first aid. They're learning about, even in the high school level, even about signs and symptoms of suicide and the kinds of issues that come with anxiety and depression in kids. It's been a really great program. And then, like even this Thursday, we're doing a suicide prevention forum in conjunction with County Behavioral Health and their new suicide intervention specialist. So we really try to do a lot of community education. I was at Cal Poly today, talking to an appropriate technology class, and they're trying to figure out how to use technology to help in poverty, basically. So they wanted to know more about homelessness and what kinds of resources people might need and how they might be helped by technology. So that's a big part of our mission. The peer advisory and advocacy team, Joel touched on that. We just had the walk out of darkness this past weekend that was meant to highlight suicide. And so it's just, again, very important to us as an organization to try to help the community understand what mental illness is. We got a grant actually through Mental Health Services Act to put a Slow the Stigma campaign together. And Super R is a Spanish language. It's a short documentary describing the mental health experiences of some Spanish-speaking folks. Again, trying to help people understand to maybe overcome that cultural barrier. And The Shaken Tree is a documentary that we also use to educate the community. We took over the SLO hotline in 2010 when it was a separate nonprofit and was possibly going to go through dissolution. So we adopted it. We joked the dowry was the bowl-a-thon. So we ran the bowl-a-thon, which was its primary funding source for many years. But now the hotline answers the phone for the inpatient unit after hours. It answers the phone for a lot of different local groups that need some human voice to answer the phone. But in this last year, we had 9,000 phone calls to the SLO hotline, and that may be a question about mental health services or somebody who's in suicidal crisis. So it's the whole range, and that's mostly staffed by volunteers. And then this is our client satisfaction survey, where we ask people about how satisfied they are with the services. And really the goals are to help people understand how they can navigate systems as well as they possibly can, how to teach people how to ride the bus and to learn about their mental illness themselves. And I think one of the things we talked about, the empathy training, and I think when I read some of the things that people say about their services, I think feeling that they're treated with respect and dignity, that their mental illness isn't sort of their primary identifier, those are all really important elements, I think, to being being part of the mental health community, is really teaching people or talking about just trying to overcome that and not letting one's mental illness really identify them. And so that people can recover, they can work, they can live independently and really have the kind of life that they deserve. So I think that is it. Have I left you stunned into silence?
You do so many things, Jill.
Thank you.
Do we have questions, Commissioner Campbell?
Yes, I am quite stunned. And I'm trying to get a grasp of who do you answer to politically?
Ooh, that's a good question. I have a board of directors. I was going to make a joke about my husband, but that seemed inappropriate. We have a 17-person board of directors, and we actually had a nominating committee meeting today, but we have family members. We have sort of the usual suspects, a couple of lawyers, a couple of bankers, but most people have a direct connection to our mission. And so that's the kind, we have a couple of retired physicians, therapists. We have a really great board of directors.
Who chooses your board of directors?
Well, the nominating committee. So we had four members of our board who basically put together a list of a couple people that we want. We've had, you know, whenever you lose, I'm sure you all have, you sit on this commission, so I imagine you've also sat on boards of directors. But it is nice to have certain skill set, and to have a lawyer who can look at our contracts is always handy, you know, to have a banker, someone who can help on that end. But having mental health professionals and people, like I said, we have several family members who've gone through the system and people with lived experience as well.
I need to ask my question more broadly.
Okay.
Do you answer to our board of supervisors, for instance?
I don't consider that I answer to the board of supervisors.
Do they tell you what to do?
Well, sometimes I ask them about doing things. 50 now, we developed ourselves and basically brought a proposal to the Board of Supervisors and said, here's our response to your request to use these 50 vouchers. Does that answer your question?
I need to broaden it further.
Okay.
Where do you get your money from?
Oh, that is actually relatively simple. About 70% of our budget comes from public services, whether that's county, state, or federal. Okay.
Thank you.
You're
that
welcome.
Helps.
Tamar?
And to sort of piggyback off of his question, I assume that you then have to provide metrics back based on your funding.
That is correct. We actually have a full-time evaluator who does help us with reporting. That's the nice thing about being the size we are, is that we can have division of labor, you know, where you really are able to do that. But metrics are a really critical part. The other 25% of our funding comes from grants and fundraising. We do, on the adult mental health side, we do charge rent, usually about 30% of somebody's income, whether it's SSI or work or general assistance. So yes, we have a robust data program. But as Joel mentioned, and same with our 50 Now program, it's very hard to get that data. I was just wanting to get updated data on 50 Now, and my poor evaluator rolled her eyes at me. Like, do you know how hard that was to get? Because it is really hard to get the jail to come up with data, the ERs. I mean, I know, you all know. So I'll give her a few days, and then I'll go back and ask again. But we do keep track of a lot of data.
Awesome. And then I had a question that may be more for Joel, but you both could take a stab. In terms of providers, and I know that you're subcontracting out on the SoundCal side for mental health providers, but is there a certain standard for the type of mental health provider that is providing services to people? So, you know, like an LCS and like at an MSW level, PhD, is there a set standard in terms of this type of services that are being provided by certain professionals?
There are. Transitions doesn't do a lot with SoCal, because SoCal has more of the mild to moderate, and we work with the more persistent and severe.
Yeah.
So, but I would say, and Joel may know better about what SoCal provides, but in our teams, we do have some very specific requirement for licensure. We actually hired our first psychiatrist. As an organization, we hadn't had a psychiatrist on staff before, and so we are moving further into the medical realm. We're talking about a full-time psychiatric nurse practitioner to join her, and I feel like we're kind of moving in that direction, but that's all still for the more severe and chronic population.
So if I can add, one of the major things that the Holman Group does is recruiting and credentialing of providers. So, you know, whatever licensure they're required to have, and they have an array of psychiatrists to LCSWs. One interesting thing with Medi-Cal and community health centers, with federally qualified health centers, is to get their full reimbursement, they actually cannot use LMFTs. They have to use licensed clinical social workers. And that's an artifice of, I don't remember whether it's federal law or state law, they point at each other. But to get full reimbursement for an FQHC, they have to hire LCSWs. But they also have some LMFTs, but, you know, they don't get the full wraparound reimbursement, which is a technical issue. Well, it's a technical issue and a big money issue.
Thank you. And one last question. Around that training, the focus groups where you found that there was this need for empathy, in addition to that, I think there was something in there that you mentioned about continuity of providers. Can you speak
so
more to
that? Right. So this is certainly on the people with serious mental illness. The county admittedly has a lot of problems in recruiting and retaining psychiatrists, and they have a lot of locum tenens, and they sort of filter through, and people wish they would see the same provider at the same time. Yeah. Right, and the county has increased salaries for psychiatrists. It's not an issue only in our county. Now, we also have a lot of competition in the county for psychiatrists because we have a very large state hospital and we have a very large state prison. So the county sort of lower, and this is the same problem CHC has in recruiting therapists, is they all end up somewhere else, or not all, but there's a lot of competition for qualified providers.
Mm-hmm. That's what we tried it with the psychiatrist we hired. She has a part-time private practice too, and so we're trying that out to see if that may be a way to have a more stable access to psychiatric professionals as somebody who's really happy with the private practice but sort of has a philanthropic side as well and is willing to work with this population.
And one thing CHC has tried with psychiatrists is telepsychiatry. Mm-hmm. There are some very large groups that are available through telemedicine or telepsychiatry. It probably works a lot better for medication management than therapy, but you know, at least then you're still getting someone who can evaluate the patient. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yes, we only have now one live psych NP in Santa Maria. The rest of the clinics, we use a telepsychiatrist. But I believe it may not be as justful for county because they're very expensive.
Right.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. But we get a funding, right? I mean,
get to charge visits for it. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Medi-Cal has their definition of telehealth as much broader than Medicare and some of the others. So I actually have professional clients that do mental health telehealth very well, but they're primarily up in our really rural areas, Shasta and you know, some of those. And it's hard to recruit psychiatrists anyway, not just our
for
county,
everyone.
But there's such a shortage of that profession that it's, you know, when somebody comes and says, can you help us recruit, we say, oh, killed me instead. No. Do we have other questions? Gina?
You know, have you actually worked with VA system as well? You know, they have a quite extensive mental health. I think they're building, and we lost some providers to a VA system.
I haven't, but I'm going to defer to Jill.
We do a little bit with the VA, but we don't do a lot of extensive services because mostly people are completely being served by the VA and probably don't need our services. But we have gotten people into VA services, some of our homeless folks, yeah, we've done that. And of course the Housing Authority has their housing project for veterans. So that's been very successful.
I have just one question. So the Bishop Street project,
mm-hmm.
What is there an age that you're looking at to put there, or what are the...
It's just adults, basically. Okay. So anyone who's over 18 and who has an open case with county mental health. So those were some of the agreements that we agreed to in optioning the property. So they have to have an open case with mental health and so be actively involved there. But anyone who's an adult, and there are some accessible units for people. We haven't served a lot of physically disabled people, but this we will have some units that will allow us to do that.
Okay. And do you know how many we serve through the Behavioral Health Treatment Court?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me see if it's on my little sheet.
I don't want you to have to go back to your data person.
No. I know. Yeah, I know. I'm intimidated by her. No, but I can email you. I don't know how many people we do serve.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Those are some of the kind of special courts that we have here in our county that not a lot of other counties really have, but they seem to work fairly well, I think. So
mm-hmm.
Good. No more questions? Well, thank you both. Oh,
thank
Susan,
you.
I'm sorry, didn't mean to ignore.
Okay, just a couple more questions. Is this presentation, Joel, you were doing this tonight because this is kind of the end of this grant?
Right.
And then is this going to be given to the supervisors?
We haven't gotten there yet. It's sort of on our list. Mm-hmm. We're doing here today.
That's right.
The Behavioral Health Board, Wednesday or Thursday,
mm-hmm.
for a shortened one because you have your suicide.
Right, we have suicide prevention forum.
Yes, it actually is one of the things Jill and they, we've sort of had Jill and Robin and myself have sort of
or like the executive.
Kept the executive right. committee for the okay. project.
And then you mentioned that there's still two other grants that are going on that are kind of picking up some of this.
Right.
And if
so, the two SAMHSA grants. So CAPSLO has taken the lead on continuing what was our steering committee. There was a big overlap, and we right. created this matrix of, well, it's the same 14 people. So those are, they've been meeting, I think they're meeting every other month at this point.
And those are going to go on for?
Well, another... let's see, the Slow Hip Grant was a four-year grant. I guess that's in its second year.
I think it's a three.
Slow Hub is a,
I think it's, a
I think it's also
grant.
A four-year grant.
A four-year grant, okay.
Okay, so for another
several
couple
more years.
Another couple of years, some of this will continue.
Right.
That's right.
Okay. And then in here they were mentioning the crisis stabilization unit that got opened, and right. how's that going?
I think it's going well. I think it had a little bit of a slow start for people to sort of understand that it was available, but from what I understand, it's gone well. The four beds have been full.
And how are people referred there?
They are referred through a variety of ways. I think primarily through calling the county, and if somebody is in crisis, they can refer. They are still wanting people to do a medical clearance at one of the hospitals, and so. But I think law enforcement can refer. Family members can refer,
and they could do a self referral if they felt.
I believe so.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And then the other thing I had a comment on, table three here on page 9, and it's just something that I've heard from some other folks, and it's the services provided by SLO mental health providers in 17. There's just, when you look at the number of visits per clients, particularly under county drug and alcohol services, 99,203 visits for essentially the same number of clients that CHC had, and they had 7,172 visits. This is one of the issues that I hear sometimes, particularly from the folks who are living in outlying areas, that they have to come into town, into San Luis, 5 days a week for a couple of hours. It's three different buses. Essentially, it takes all day. And they're supposed to be working to pay off their fines and everything else. And this is just kind of onerous. And so are we tracking to see, is it really that much more effective for the clients to be coming in there that often because everybody else doesn't seem to be at that level?
Well, some of these contacts are group contacts. You know,
right.
I think better to ask the question of behavioral health.
Yeah. Okay. So. Thank you.
Okay, well, again, thank you both for
thank
coming
you.
And spending time with
thank
us
Thank you
today.
For inviting me.
It's a lot of information.
Thanks.
Okay. All right. Next up is Dr. Borenstein and our public health report for this month.
Thanks. I'm going to try to keep up with Jill Bolster-White tonight because I have quite a few bullets, which I don't always, but... She really impressed me. Anyway, no, I won't keep us here all evening. But thank you to my colleagues. That's a really important area that I've been proud to be engaged in. The integration of behavioral and medical care is always a real challenge. So the first thing I want to do is introduce you to the gentleman to my right. Dr. Rick Rosen is the new deputy health officer for the county of San Luis Obispo. So
welcome.
He works in my building at 2191 Johnson down the hall. And he's already got up to his elbows in communicable disease and other animals and whatnot. And is really slowly trying to get the feel for being in this county. I don't know if you want to add anything, but comes to us, originally as a surgeon, we don't hold that against him. He saw the light and went back to school and has been trained in public health and medical management. So we're really lucky, and I'm glad to have a compatriot. So you can ask either one of us public health questions going forward. So the second thing I want to do is announce, remind the public that we are having, we're not in competition with the Take Back drug on the Saturday, but on Sunday morning, for those who miss the drug Take Back, and we hope to get as many people as we can, because remember that we also do our annual flu clinics as an exercise in emergency preparedness. So we have a three-hour clinic in two places in the county, and we try to push through as many people as we can and really staff up, because this is not only our public service to give free flu shots to the public, as well as our employees and their family members for prevention of flu, but is also one of the ways in which we test our systems for surge capacity should we be faced with a severe or a novel flu virus. So those are happening 9 to noon on Sunday, the 21st, and this year in Arroyo Grande, it will be at the Five Cities Fire Authority, Fire Station 1, and in Atascadero at Colony Park. So come one, come all. And we will have varying flu shots of different types. We do not have the senior higher dose. So if folks really want that, they have to get that elsewhere. They can get that through our regular public health clinics as well as other locations like pharmacies. I did want to tell you that we had just a couple of weeks ago, I participated an available consultant to, but really Sierra Vista put on a CME program for community physicians about Valley Fever. We were lucky as a community to get probably the god of Valley Fever from the state of California, from Kern County, came and spoke to a packed room of probably 75 physicians who, we don't get usually that kind of attendance. So people are aware and seeing it throughout their practices that we continue to go through the roof with our number of Valley Fever cases. And so this was a really good presentation to our community docs. I wanted to mention that we're getting a small grant from the state public health department from the Office on AIDS as part of the governor's budget for the current fiscal year. State general funds were put in to enhance outreach, education, testing, linkage to care, a whole bunch of things for HIV, which is, again, on the rise. You may have seen a news story from us recently in which we've had a cluster of HIV cases that probably double or triple what we usually see in a period of time. Like for a quarter, we had 7 cases over 4 months. We were up towards 11, 4 or 5 months. So that's a pretty high number in a county that typically would see about 10 or 12 in a year. Of all ages, demographics, risk exposure categories, and so we're working with Access Support Network, ASN, and going to be using this money primarily to buy testing kits for both HIV and hepatitis C, something often you see co-infection, and trying to get it'll purchase about 1,000 test kits, and also trying to get it into the jail as a way of identifying those who are not aware of their status. Lots of different organizations are going to be benefiting from a new funding source from the Department of Healthcare Services at the state level that is making naloxone available free of charge to lots of organizations, law enforcement, harm reduction programs, drug and alcohol services, clinics of all types. And in this county, I know that several organizations have already put in applications to try to get more naloxone available in the community. For those who don't recall, that naloxone is the drug that is the antidote to opioid overdose. Another thing that we're working on is dealing with the onslaught of youth use of e-cigarettes and The fact that there are now like 15,000, I can't even imagine who spends their days coming up with names of these, you know, unicorn star and mushy marshmallow and what have, 15,000 different flavors of product that can be put into these e-cigarettes. And I learned from a state meeting recently that 23 jurisdictions in the state of California thus far have banned the use of flavors and or menthol in tobacco products. So that's one of the things that our tobacco control program is going to be looking at, is ways that we can really get ahead of this onslaught in terms of youth use and the marketing that's happening with youth. I did want to announce, in case folks had not heard it from the board, action that occurred 2 weeks ago, that the board has recommended that the jail medical and mental health care be outsourced, and the county is currently in negotiations with the lead proposer, and things are moving rather rapidly. It is expected that the county will have effectuated a contract with a private entity as early as February of next year, and we, the health agency, are working with the employees who are going to be infected. They're all going to be offered jobs with the new provider, but also to provide transfer opportunities that those who want to stay with the county can hopefully do so. And just two more announcements of activities. This Friday, some of you have heard about Dr. Chasnoff. He was the one who originally got our perinatal screening program off the ground called 4Ps Plus, which is an attempt to get universal screening amongst pregnant women by their obstetricians for any substance use. We continue to have high rates in this county of use in pregnancy of alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. And so he hasn't been in our county in a while. He will be here all day for a program that's focused on alcohol and cannabis use in pregnancy. It's taking place at Cuesta College on this Friday. And then on November 7th, First Five and Public Health, and we've also have been planning for a pediatric town hall focused on strengthening developmental screening and referral practices. This is, I think I've previously mentioned, our attempts to get a Help Me Grow program, not to be confused with the cannabis program I just mentioned, but to help to develop a universal screening for developmental delay amongst youth in our county, the very young ones. And so we've already gotten upwards of 15 pediatricians planning to come to this, and we're going to be looking at mechanisms to ease really comprehensive developmental screening into pediatric practices, being co-sponsored, held at Dignity Facility, co-sponsored by SenCal Health and the American Academy of Pediatrics, and that's a CME program for physicians and CEUs for others. So that is on the evening of November 7th, held at the Copeland Center at French Hospital. And then I did have one more last, unfortunately, sad announcement. I think most of you are too new to know one of our former health commissioners who was struggling for a time with cancer, did pass away last week, Gil Blonsley. And he had been a commissioner for a couple of years, going back a few years, but I did want to share that news with you for those of you who know him. So anyway, and with that, I will pass it back over to you.
Anyone have questions for Dr. Bornstein?
No, I just wanted to say that anybody that's got the opportunity to hear Dr. Chasnoff, he's just extraordinary. And what was interesting when, and I'm sorry to hear that our rates are still pretty high, But I remember that when he first got them, he was quite surprised at how high they were in our county, because we beat out inner city Chicago and some of the other areas where you would have expected them to be so high. But it has to do because our county is mostly Caucasian and highly educated. So we may not be reaching the people we need to reach in understanding why they shouldn't be drinking while they're pregnant. So check it out.
Any other questions? I have one about the new shingles vaccine. Is it hard in our county to get it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we and the pharmacies that had been offering it are all taking wait lists at present. It is trickling in, so we are getting people off the wait list, but it's taking about 3 weeks at least, and that wait list may continue to grow at a higher pace than the actual
supply.
So people
should call and get on a wait list then at least, probably?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And it is a two-dose series, yeah. And so we don't want people to think, well, I'll let other people, you know, get theirs. It really is not considered to be effective unless you get the two doses separated by a minimum of 2 months.
All right. We have an action item next before we go on to Health Commissioner updates. Unfortunately, when Chris Kington Barker had to resign, that left us an opening in our vice chair position. So we had to do a little redoing of our executive committee. So I'd like to recommend that Jean Raymond move up to the vice chair, and Tamar has graciously said that she would accept the secretary position. So with that, I would entertain a motion to accept the recommendation and have our executive committee be myself as chair, Jean Raymond as vice chair, and Tamar as secretary.
I motion.
Second. Thank you. I think we can just do a voice vote. All those in favor of the recommendation, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? All right. Welcome, ladies. Glad to have you. Health Commissioner updates. Gina, let's start down with you.
So I guess we can pound on our flu vaccine again. So CHC offers most of the clinics up and down the county. If you call your CHC clinic, every week there is a flu vaccine clinic. It's $20 for regular flu vaccine. It's $35 for high dose for people over 65 years old. But we also have if you go to CHC website under flu vaccine, there is a three no-cost vaccine dates that CHC offer in October. We're probably going to offer some more in November and December, but right now we have three dates. You can just go to those flu vaccine event, and it's free.
So those people trying to choose between the regular dose and the high dose?
So regular dose is people under 64 and below. So 64 and 11 months and 29 days. And if you are 65 years old, then you should get a high dose. Yeah.
And it's $30 for the?
$35 for high dose, $20 for regular vaccine.
Okay. And does Medicare not cover that for the 65-year-olds and over?
It should cover, but normally it's cover when you're coming in for other appointments. So people who don't have any conditions and you have nothing to come in for, but you need to get a vaccine, then you can come in. It's called the, you know, nearest CHC clinic.
Oh, because you're an FQ and you have to have a, I see, but why it's the $30. Okay.
Yeah.
Alisa, we won't ask you for one today, but you're on the hook. No. Jean?
I attended the Adult Services Policy Council, two meetings since our last meeting. One of them was after a meeting in September. And the Alzheimer's Association's Sonia Banco, she really gave a great presentation and really focused on caregivers and the support groups that we really need to have in our community. So we really can call in and get some access, and they'll hook you up with some kind of care support. And then the next meeting was just last Friday, and PathPoint gave a presentation, and I had never realized how involved they are in the community, and that's something maybe our community would like to know more about, people with disabilities actually giving back in the community and really integrating things. I also did attend the Commission on Aging, and it was interesting to see actually, two of their board members gave a presentation on the senior care crisis, trends, critical needs, and it's of our county. And it was really kind of interesting, too. That's another thing. I did attend, and I don't know if you're going to give the report on health and housing, building the connection. I attended that. And are you going to be talking about it? Okay. There was a speaker and a panel, and the speaker was talking under one roof how comprehensive, healthy housing strategies improve health outcomes, and it was a great presentation, and it was nice to see the networking in our community, all the people wanting to make sure that we do get housing for people, and it'll improve health.
Tamar?
I just wanted to mention that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and for anyone that might be watching that may need help or services, I just wanted to call out RISE, and the phone number is 855-886-RISE, 855-886-7473.
Commissioner Campbell?
There's nothing new, really, on the Human Trafficking Coalition. It's interesting to note that there seems to be an increase in arrests published in the paper, which I think is helpful. But they primarily, at least the group that I attend, focuses on community education and awareness and knowing what to look for and what to report. The other coalition that I attend is the Tobacco Control Coalition. The most recent meeting last week focused on the challenges of reaching kids about this epidemic. I had hoped they might be here tonight to give us some data from their surveys, and maybe we can get them here in the near future just for a brief presentation on that. We note that the tobacco industry is working really hard to fight back, and I think they're going to be formidable in this regard. And nobody really knows what kind of message to give to the 15 and 16-year-olds who see their friends doing this and seems to be harmless. And I think that's figuring out what the message is and hopefully getting some usable data on the actual risks in the near future would be really helpful. But for now, it's a conundrum.
It was interesting after our last month's meeting and having that topic that just in the next day or two, the FDA came out with a couple of things. And so, yeah. Okay. Thanks, Bob. Susan?
Mm-hmm. I attended my first five meeting, the first one, and it was interesting. It was their end of the fiscal year report on all the different programs they monitor, and then an audit of all of the money involved with all those different programs. So it looks like they're pretty thorough with everything, and they do have a number of programs going on. But they'll meet again next week, actually. And so hopefully in my next report, I'll have a little better idea of what they're doing and what's coming up. With the Homeless Services Oversight Council right now, what we're focusing on is there is $4.2 million coming down to this county to provide some kind of housing and services for homeless. And we're not quite sure what all the parameters are. First, it was going to be this last fall, but it was coming up so fast that they moved it to the spring for the applications. But it's one-time funding, so they want to see it spent more on capital projects and things that will really actually create beds and direct services. So I'll know more about that. And if anybody's interested, next Tuesday and next Thursday from 9 to 11 at the Slo City Library, there will be informational opportunities. The first one's going to be more about what kinds of programs they're looking at, support services. And then on Thursday, they'll be discussing the financial end of it and the application process and that. So if people are interested, they can show up then. It's called the, and I don't know what the acronym's for, but it's the HEAP, H-E-A-P funds. So we'll know more by next month.
I have a couple things to report. Oral Health Coalition met. Joel was there, and we went over. He was putting together the strategic plan. We broke down into groups, had some interesting discussions about the report, and it's back in his hands now to tweak and finalize and decide how much duplication there is, and then he'll put it all together. I'm also happy to say that Catherine will be going to the Oral Health Coalition from now on, so I will step aside on that one very gladly. So Healthy Communities Work Group, we had our what we think is a successful health and housing meeting. We had a fairly good attendance, a good panel, as Jean had mentioned. We're going to continue that discussion with Heal Slo when they have their first meeting in quite a while, coming up in November. And Susan, are you still going to go for me on that? Thank you. So they will, housing is one of, or healthy communities is one of their focus groups. And so they'll be continuing the housing discussion at that time. But thank you, commissioners who were there. I hope that you did find it helpful at that point. I did for the first time attend the, it has a new name, it used to be FEPAC and now it's the San Luis County Healthcare, it's a long one.
Yeah, Disaster Healthcare Advisory Committee.
Right. Okay, thank you, Penny. So we talked about it meets quarterly. So we had a presentation from, that had to do with PG&E and their community wildfire safety program, where they're going to start shutting off electricity in times, and they started this week, actually, not in our county, but in other parts of the state, over by Yosemite and up by Redding. I think there were quite a number of that, but they'll be shutting down our electricity in those terrible needs. And I noticed the schools were all closed up there also, so I'm sure the kids were all happy in those areas. We also did talk about the flu shot clinics that are coming up, because as Dr. Bornstein mentioned, that's part of our preparedness situation. We also talked about they are almost at the point of starting to develop a website, and Penny jump in if I'm getting this wrong, and I'll try to bring more information after the next meeting. But they're wanting to do a website that tells people where to go, that will be a resource for people during an emergency or a disaster. There's a really good one that apparently San Diego has done that has basically three links: what to do to prepare at the time of the emergency, where do you go for resources, and then post-emergency, what are your resources for help in that? So they have to, I believe, they have to go to the Board of Supervisors to get some okay to do a few things, but they are starting to work on that for our county. So won't happen, you know, how long it takes to do a website. So it won't happen right away, but they are working on it. So it was an interesting meeting. I enjoyed attending that. And I think that's all that I did this time around. So our committee reports themselves, nominating. We have two new commissioners, which we're thankful
for. Two new commissioners. We still have two vacancies, but I think there's someone that has taken at least asked for some information so that they can apply. So that's one more. So if you know of anyone or anyone in the audience would like to become a commissioner, you can always access our website and get more information.
Okay. So I'll remind everybody that November, our meeting will be the third Monday, not the second Monday, because we have a holiday there. And I know Commissioner Raymond will not be with us because she's going to go off and celebrate her birthday in Europe. But the rest of us will hopefully be here. Does anybody else have anything else for this evening? If not, we will stand adjourned.